Hi, Corey Olson here. The other day, I had the opportunity to sit down with KMO, the host of the Sea Realm podcast. He had asked to do an interview with me for his podcast, but we got so caught up in talking about Tolkien, and in particular the Silmarillion, that we decided to break the session up into two halves. The first half I am posting here, as part of my series of Tolkien chats. The second half will be broadcast on KMO's Sea Realm podcast in a few days. We start off with a few questions that KMO had about the Silmarillion.
There was Eru, the One, who in Arda is called...
Iluvatar.
So the British actor they have reading the audiobook says Aluvatar, or something silly like that.
Yeah. There are a couple places... Actually, he does an okay job most of the time, mm-hmm. but there are a couple ones which he... Now, there I think he's using the default. Again, normally it's the second to last syllable, so
right.
Iluvatar would sort of sound right, but... Tolkien puts the accents in, which are stress marks, so it's actually designed to be a pronunciation aid. So there's an accent on the U in Iluvatar to tell mm-hmm. you that's the stress, because it's an exception to the rule. It's the second instead of the third syllable that's stressed, but yeah.
What's really neat, I mean, I know your students have pointed it out, that these words, which have no... etymological relationship to English words that we use, sound like English words. Like Iluvatar sounds like somebody who brings light.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny because I would like to think that he intended that as a kind of deliberate pun, you know, because certainly Iluvatar is associated with light, and he may well have been thinking that, but philologists often don't think of those things, it seems. That is, he is so focused on the etymology of the word and what it means that he would... I mean, the joke with my students, of course, is Tyrion upon Tuna. And and I feel really pretty confident that Tuna, it never even occurred to him.
Yeah.
You know,
he probably didn't eat a lot of tuna.
Yeah. And have I told you my the C.S. Lewis story that I cite to back up my theory about his not being aware of it?
It might be in a podcast, but this is our first meeting. So.
Yeah, so well, it's the scene from Perelandra, C.S. Lewis's the second novel in C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, and the protagonist of the space trilogy, Ransom, Elwin Ransom, is based on Tolkien. He's a Cambridge philologist, and there's this moment in Perelandra where his last name is Ransom, as I say, and there's this scene where. Basically, he's speaking to a voice which essentially makes a pun on his name, Ransom. And Ransom is described as sort of realizing for the first time, oh, yeah, my last name is Ransom. Like, because, you know, he himself had always thought of only the etymology of it and knew exactly
right.
where it came from, and so it had never even occurred to him that...
Hold
that,
the phone.
Yeah, that the name actually meant something in modern English. So, I mean, and just Lewis kind of... depicting that of the character based on Tolkien, it's hard for me to imagine that. I sort of see it kind of a gentle teasing there, I think, and I would imagine that Tolkien did that kind of thing. So
you did have that in a podcast, I recommend.
Yeah, I think I did mention that. But anyway, it's definitely fun. But Iluvatar, yeah, I the pun sure works, whether he meant it or not.
Well, I've been listening to and enjoying the Tolkien Professor podcast, I think since 2009, August or September, somewhere in there. It inspired me to go and check The Hobbit out at the library. I read The Hobbit, and then I read it aloud to my kids.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, The Hobbit's very fresh in my brain. And your very inspiring lectures prompted me to get this, The Silmarillion.
Fantastic.
Which I had tried to read a while back, I think in my teens, didn't get through it, and that's my bookmark.
Hey, that's good. You know, any bookmark in the Silmarillion, any honest bookmark that is past the first 20 pages, you've done well. You know, most people by 20 pages are done with it if they're not going to make it. So,
yes.
So, you know,
and for those who don't know, the Silmarillion is basically the folklore of the elves collected by Bilbo and Rivendell. And it's hard going because there's no central narrative, there is no central accessible character like you have in The Lord of the Rings. There are no hobbits to frame it and to put all these larger-than-life characters in a proper frame. And you've been giving some advice to your students and also to me about getting through it, because it is rewarding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I definitely, I sort of feel like the more people I can get to actually get through the Silmarillion, the more satisfied I am with my job. You know, I feel like my work is done if I've done that. But yeah, and the two main things that I always say to people about the Silmarillion is, first of all, the number one problem is all the names. I mean, Tolkien just loves names. There are names all over the place. And not only are there, you know, hundreds and hundreds of characters and places and small localities and things which have names, but they'll all have multiple names too. And not even just names in multiple languages, as we sometimes see in The Lord of the Rings, where, for instance, you know, we learned the names of the three mountains above Moria in the languages of elves, dwarves, and men. But I'm not even talking about that kind of, but just people, like, their names change, or their, you know, some people call them this and some people call them that, which mean different things. And so just trying to keep track of all the names is something which is really bewildering to a lot of people. It was funny. Someone was asking me about George R. R. Martin's fantasy series recently, and if I read it and if I liked it. And I said, yeah, I mean, I think it's fine.
I haven't read it. What is it?
It's not my favorite. Song of Ice and Fire. It's this epic, hugely epic fantasy series, which is still ongoing and much delayed, actually, to the irritation of many. But anyway, that one of the objections that people have is like, oh, you know, well, Martin is good, but there's so many names. And it was funny, you know, coming from Tolkien and being used to the Silmarillion, when I read Martin, it didn't even strike me. I was like, it never even would have occurred to me that there were a lot of names in this book. Because, I mean, all the characters, by and large, only have one name. I mean, that's not hard.
How easy is that?
Yeah. Exactly. But anyway, so my main advice is just don't try to keep track of all the names. Don't try to memorize them all. You don't need to know them all. You know, it's perfectly okay. The book isn't a novel. You know, you're not supposed to be. It's not like a core of central characters that you're following from one end to the next. It's a collection of stories, a collection of legends from the ancient days. So it's okay to take each legend episodically. Of course, they do build on things that happened previously and everything. So, you know, it's good to have some sense of what's going on. But just pay attention to the stories. Don't try to, whatever you do, don't try to make a family tree. Don't try to write stuff out, because there's just too much to try to keep track of. It's like, as I've mentioned to you before, it's like reading the Old Testament for the first time and, you know, not going on until you've, like, memorized every genealogy. I mean, you're not going to get out of chapter 5 if you do that. So just let it roll and keep going. And the stories will really then begin to grip you and draw you in. And then once you read the stories and reread the stories, you're able to, you know, as time goes on, familiarize yourself more and more. And, you know, and then down the road, you'll reach the point where you'll be able to, you know, remember the difference between Finrod and Fingon and all of those things. But you don't really need to worry about that too much the first time. The second piece of advice that I have is read it aloud, if possible. I know the names are a stumbling block, and you can skip over them but the prose style is so different from The Lord of the Rings and from The Hobbit. I say it's totally different from The Lord of the Rings. Not all of The Lord of the Rings. There are moments in The Lord of the Rings where his prose style sort of ascends up to a place which is near where he's at the Silmarillion all the time. You know, I think of some moments in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, for instance. There are a couple moments. Think even of the scene when Eowyn and Aragorn say goodbye, when he leaves her behind to go into the paths of the dead, and she's begging to be taken along. There's a moment there where he jumps up to high style. You know, and she looked as one who likes not that which is said. You know, I mean, he gets very sort of, formal. And it's clear these are the moments which are sort of legendary moments. You know, the things, you know, these are the bits that are going to be retold. And those are the times when he will match that stylistically. Well, that's the register the Silmarillion lives in all the time. It's a more archaic, and it's designed to sound like ancient legend. You know, it's designed to sound like something that was written thousands of years ago. And he does a really good job with that. The prose, when you get used to it, is really quite beautiful. I mean, I think the Silmarillion not only is genuinely my favorite book by Tolkien, but I think contains some of his best and most powerful writing. I mean, it is remarkable what he does in the Silmarillion. But
would you care to read a passage?
Sure. Let's see.
So what are we going to hear?
I'm going to read from the Einmulindale, that is the creation story.
I do love the Einmulindale. That I've read again and again. I've read it aloud to other people.
That one has
fallen into place for me.
Yes, yes. Let's see. So we have, for those of you who don't know the Silmarillion, before the beginning of time, Ilúvatar, the one who is basically God, comes to the Ainur, who are basically angelic beings that he has created, and he declares to them a mighty theme that he wants them to sing. Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, although he declares this theme to them that he wants them to do, they are supposed to adorn it themselves. So they're all improvising, basically in harmony on this theme, but there is the greatest of the Ainur, whose name is Melkor, into whose heart it came to interweave matters of his own imagining that were not in accord with the theme of Ilúvatar. And so he begins to conceive thoughts of his own that are unlike his brethren. Now some of these thoughts he wove into his music, and straightway discord arose about him, and many that sang nigh him grew despondent, and their thought was disturbed, and their music faltered, and some began to attune their music to his rather than to the thought which they had at first. Then the discord of Melkor spread ever wider, and the melodies which had been heard before foundered in a sea of turbulent sound. But Ilúvatar sat and hearkened until it seemed that about his throne there was a raging storm, as of dark waters that made war one upon another in an endless wrath that would not be assuaged. Then Ilúvatar arose, and the Ainur perceived that he smiled, and he lifted up his left hand, and a new theme began amid the storm, like and yet unlike to the former theme, and it gathered power and had new beauty. But the discord of Melkor rose in uproar and contended with it, and again there was a war of sound more violent than before, until many of the Ainur were dismayed and sang no longer, and Melkor had the mastery. Then Ilúvatar arose, and the Ainur perceived that his countenance was stern, and he lifted up his right hand, and behold, a third theme grew amid the confusion, and it was unlike the others. For it seemed at first soft and sweet, a mere rippling of gentle sounds and delicate melodies, but it could not be quenched, and it took to itself power and profundity. And it seemed at last that there were two musics progressing at one time before the seat of Ilúvatar, and they were utterly at variance. The one was deep and wide and beautiful, but slow and blended with an immeasurable sorrow, from which its beauty chiefly came. The other had now achieved a unity of its own, but it was loud and vain and endlessly repeated, and it had little harmony, but rather a clamorous unison, as of many trumpets braying upon a few notes. And it essayed to drown the other music by the violence of its voice, but it seemed that its most triumphant notes were taken by the other and woven into its own solemn pattern. In the midst of this strife, whereat the halls of Ilúvatar shook, and a tremor ran out into the silences yet unmoved, Ilúvatar arose a third time, and his face was terrible to behold. Then he raised up both his hands, and in one chord, deeper than the abyss, higher than the firmament, piercing as the light of the eye of Ilúvatar, the music ceased.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who knows quite a bit about the Silmarillion from listening to your podcast. For example, I know that Ilúvatar is God.
Yeah.
And that the next set of beings down the hierarchy of being from Ilúvatar are the sort of aspects of his mind which each conform, or they comprise an individual being, and these are
the Ainur.
The Ainur.
Which are called, of course, their names change. Mm-hmm. Originally, the whole choir of beings are called the Ainur, and that's sort of the collective name. When some of them choose to enter into the world after it's created and sort of become the stewards and caretakers of the world, and they become they are called the Valar. Their name is changed to the Valar when they come down. So for the rest of the Silmarillion, it's mostly the Valar that people are sort of dealing with. But yes, the Ainur is the name of the group.
Mm-hmm. And so Ilúvatar proposes the theme. Mm-hmm. You all riff on this theme. I'm going to listen and just kick back and enjoy. And then Melkor, who is the greatest, is he, I know Tolkien doesn't like, one-for-one correspondence, but is Melkor Satan?
He is basically the Lucifer figure. I mean, yeah. The parallel is so close that no protestations could possibly deny it. I mean, he is the greatest of the angelic forces, and he's the one who falls and draws other with him. And so, yeah, I mean, there is no other Satan. There is no other Satan figure. It's not to say that, you know, Melkor is Satan. That's the kind of language that Tolkien resists, and not necessarily because he's resisting the signification so much, but that it's oversimplifying. Like, he doesn't want you to be thinking about Satan, like taking what you know about Satan and applying it to Melkor,
right?
Because that's not he's a different character. Is he parallel to Satan? No question. I mean, yes, definitely. Definitely.
Even worse than applying what you know about Satan to Melkor would be applying what you think you know about Satan.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No. And that's the main thing that Tolkien disliked. You know, with his objections to allegory and his objections to, you know, the biography of the author and everything else, the main thing is that he wants people to read the stories on their own ground and to just, you know, to not to just be kind of importing a whole bunch of other stuff to the stories and using that as a way to kind of reform the stories or reimagine them, but just to see what's there.
So below the Ainur cum Valar are other beings. Who are they?
Well, basically, there are only two mm-hmm. categories of being that it sets out. You've got the Ainur and you've got the children of Iluvatar, who are elves and men. Dwarves come along later. They're kind of like the stepchildren of Iluvatar.
But isn't there a level between those two, the Maiar?
Well, the Maiar are Ainur, technically. Mm-hmm. So of the spirits who came into the world, there is basically a hierarchy among them. Not all of the Ainur are equally powerful or sort of equally, well, because they're equally significant, that sounds unnecessarily insulting, but anyway, they're not all of the same magnitude. And so when they come down into the world, this doesn't seem to be the case. We don't get any sense of clear, like, division or classification pre-descent into Arda, which Arda mm-hmm. is the name for the world as a whole. Before their descent into Arda, there's no sense of classification, but the Ainur who descend, some of them are the Valar and some of them are the Maiar. Mm-hmm. So,
and both of those words are plural.
Yes. The singular, you drop the R. Mm-hmm. So so an Ainu is singular, a Maia is singular, and a Vala is singular. Mm-hmm. So the Maiar and the Valar are become sort of the two classifications. You've got the great ones of the spirits, and they're the Valar. And then you've got all the rest of them, which are sort of collectively called the Maiar. And so that includes both some sort of lesser, but still often very powerful spirits, like Ossé and Uinen, for instance, who are the two chief Maiar who work under Ulmo, who's the Valar, who primarily oversees water and the seas. And Ossé and Uinen are in charge of, you know, tides and coastal waters. They are the ones, even more than Ulmo, that mariners are kind of concerned with, because they're the one who actually sort of deal with the surface of the water.
Yeah, Ulmo is the CEO of the ocean. You're never going to encounter him.
Yeah, very
you
rarely.
You need to get in good with the customer service folks.
Right. Very rarely are you going to encounter Ulmo, yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly not as a sailor. So, yeah, it's Ulmo. And it's, you know, it's not just that...
I'm sure Tolkien would hate my metaphor just
now. Probably, yes. A very orcish metaphor. I think he often in his letters talks about, you know, corporate people and military people as orcs. Ulmo is made, so he's the caretaker of the seas and all the water. But of course, this is because that was the part of the music that he sang at first. Water and the sound of water comes from Ulmo's, strand of the great music. He was the one who conceived of water. And so that's why unlike, for instance, this is an important difference between Tolkien's mythology here and, say, Greek mythology. Sometimes often people will want to make comparisons and say, okay, the head of the Valar is Manwë, who is over the sky and the clouds, and then you've got, you know, so he's obviously the Zeus figure, and then you've got the Poseidon figure in Ulmo. But and Mandos, I guess, would be the closest parallel to Hades. But there's a huge difference, which is that in Greek mythology, those three brothers, Zeus and Hades and Poseidon, have their realms determined by lot. I mean, they cast lots, and one of them gets the sky, and one of them gets the sea, and one of them gets the booby prize, and, and is down in the underworld. As you know, in the Iliad, Poseidon is quick to remind when he's doing something that Zeus doesn't want him to do in the Iliad, and Zeus sends a messenger down to yell at him, and Poseidon reminds him, is like, hey, but you know, if not for the fact that, like, you know, the lots could have gone otherwise, and then I would have been king, so don't you boss me around, brother. And then he does end up actually letting himself be bossed around. But anyway, the point is that there's no intrinsic connection between the gods, whereas in Tolkien's there absolutely is. It doesn't work like that at all. It's not just that, you know, the Valar come down and they're like, all right, well, teamwork, let's split this up and we'll all do. They came down because they love the earth, because they love the music that they sang, and those aspects of the earth are the fruit of their own music, the fruit of their own thought. Not just, I mean, Ilúvatar creates through them, and not just through them as instruments like they're a piano he's playing on, but they're improv. What Tolkien does in the Ainur Indoe, with basically predestination and free will, is remarkable. It's one of the most profound literary treatments of the subject that I know of. Both of them are, the world is created just as Ilúvatar wanted it. He is in control the whole time, and yet it is also, at the same time, the free choice of the Ainur, which has contributed to what has been made, but yet nothing is made that he doesn't want made. So that's pretty remarkable. But as I say, the thing to remember is that those Valar are overseeing their own realm, something that is their own realm, and something which is really their own heart, their own passion, their own a reflection of their own mind, in ways which is just not true of most other pantheon.
Well, in the Greek pantheon, there's no Ilúvatar.
Right, right. At least not. Exactly. This is of course the objection Plato had to it. He wanted an Ilúvatar, and to get rid of the rest. There isn't. It's not just. You have to look at things like that. That is the relationship between the Valar and the world. And the way that that the character of that relationship is different from something like Greek mythology, in order to really see. I mean, there are some people who are tempted to say things like, well, see, Tolkien is just kind of Christianized, you know, a pagan mythology like that. He's made a mythology, you know, a pantheon, which is basically like a pagan pantheon, but, you know, then we just sort of slap a monotheistic god on top and we're good, right? I mean, it, you know, this is not really how it works at all. I mean, the difference is, are really profound, but you really and so in some ways the similarities to pagan pantheons are more superficial than the Christianization is. I don't even like the word Christianized, and part of that also is sort of a professional objection too. People use that of the Middle Ages all the time, and I think that people vastly misunderstand the relationship between medieval Christendom and pagan tradition and you know, the Greco-Roman past.
And this conversation can go anywhere, but I'm going to put up a roadblock and say we're not going down Beowulf.
Okay, that's all right. We don't have to talk about Beowulf. The Beowulf is a Christian poet, but I won't talk about that. But again, and I just to expand on that for 1 minute, because I do think that it is important and relevant to Tolkien. One mistake that people often make about medieval Christian treatment of pagan ideas is that they're basically just trying to kind of clean it up and whitewash it, and like, let's kind of incorporate this because people like this, so we'll kind of bring this in, and then we can sort of bring more people or keep people happy, but, you know, still keep it sort of officially Christian. The reason that they kept these things around is because of the profound respect that they had for the pagans. I mean, in the Middle Ages, they believed quite firmly that the world was in decline, that people are getting dumber and less wise every generation, which means that people like Plato and Aristotle and Virgil and Ovid must be just way smarter, way wiser than we are. So you don't just dump it. Even when there are things that they say which appears plainly to contradict the Bible, what the medievals did was like, well, they must know what they're talking about. I mean, these wise pagans must have known what they were talking about. Now, they didn't have revelation, so they don't know the whole picture themselves. But clearly, there's something in what they're saying. This is why the medieval cosmos is so similar and so, you know, still retains so much of the old pagan ideas, like that, you know, how we take the pagan gods and we in the Middle Ages understand them as planetary intelligences. They believed perfectly orthodox Christians in the Middle Ages believed in a literal spirit in the planet Venus, which had an effect on the world, which looked actually quite similar to the kind of effects that the pagan Venus often had. They did this because, again, they were convinced, surely these guys must have known what they were talking about, that there's something really to this. Now, we can contextualize it. We medieval Christians can contextualize, because now we have the benefit of this revelation that, you know, they didn't have. So with the help of that, we can now put it in a bigger picture and understand it a little bit more fully. But, you know, they were not in the business of just chucking stuff out because they had too much respect for it. So, and Tolkien had a very similar kind of view. It's not that he was convinced of the same thing as far as the decline of knowledge and wisdom and things like that necessarily, but he had a tremendous respect for pagan mythologies, and he believed there was real wisdom and there was real truth in those, and that, you know, in no way did a belief in Christianity require you to say, because I believe Christianity is true, therefore everything ever said by any other religion or tradition must be 100% false. That there was truth in myth. That the central importance of myth was really important to him. And so when he makes myth, which is what he's doing here, there are good reasons why his myth sounds like a pagan myth in some ways, and his pantheon looks like a pagan pantheon in some ways, because he's kind of secretly, you know, like being ostensibly Christian while secretly like going back to pagan stuff, but rather because he believed that those pagan pantheons and mythologies themselves also pointed to a truth which was perfectly in harmony with the truth revealed in the Bible. So, I mean, that was basically the world that Tolkien lived in, and you can see that in the mythology that he writes.
I'm tempted to talk about this book by Walter Cruttenden called Lost Star of Myth and Time, because I saw a very real connection, seemingly, in what you were saying just now about how in medieval Christendom, the Christians would look at the achievements of the pagans that came before them and think, wow, that is something that we are not going to attain.
Yeah.
And Cruttenden's idea is that the precession of the equinoxes is an effect of our star, soul, being in a binary star system and circling around a central point of gravity with another star that we don't see. And that as we approach this other star, it has an effect on human consciousness and it elevates it. And we get grand civilizations and things, you know, civilizations that could build pyramids and such. And then as we're moving away, then consciousness is degrading. And that the Indian Yugas and the Dark Ages and the times in our history, in Western history, which we think of as enlightened periods, correspond to these phases. And it could well be that in the Middle Ages, consciousness was in fact on the downhill slide and that people could see it and that it was obvious because look at what the ancients could do that we can't do. So that's a dangerous segue. We'll just leave off there. You mentioned an author who'd written an epic fantasy series that I haven't read. I haven't read any fantasy really other than Tolkien. I've read a lot of science fiction. Mm-hmm. There's a science fiction author named Michael Swanwick. Are you familiar with him?
I'm not.
He wrote a book called The Iron Dragon's Daughter. And then the sequel is The Dragons of Babel. And basically it's where the modern world and fairy meet. And you have, you know, elves and trolls and dwarves, but you also have television and motorcycles and this dragon who is a central character in The Iron Dragon's Daughter is basically a bomber in a war. You know, he flies over the enemy and he drops bombs. And he's built by dwarves in a factory, but he's also a living being. And for some reason, he gets it into his mind to escape, and he inducts this young girl who's basically an indentured servant in this factory, and they escape together. And she is the Iron Dragon's daughter. And it's described... And Swenwick is a Tolkien aficionado scholar, but his work is described as the anti-Tolkien, because the elves, while they are grand and sophisticated, they're also really callous and just evil and, you know, abusive, which until I read the Silmarillion, I would have agreed, yeah, that's the anti-Tolkien, but no, Feanor is awful.
Yeah, it's one thing we get in the Silmarillion, which we don't really see anywhere else, is elves going bad. Mm-hmm. Elves can fall, do fall, and get in Feanor. Though, of course, Feanor is himself is tragic. I mean, there's this one, that wonderful moment where the Valar, when Feanor rebels, they weep over the darkening of Valinor, I mean, over the huge tragedy that just happened and the destruction of the trees. But they weep just as much over the marring of Feanor and think about, you know, the how what he could have done, how he could have been. You know, because he was the most powerful, the most gifted of all of the children of Iluvatar, the greatest child of Iluvatar ever made.
Much like Melkor.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And goes the same way. And there's kind of a trend with that, actually. And this is, you know, something which becomes just sort of one small example, and there are hundreds of examples of ways in which your reading of The Lord of the Rings is really enriched by knowing the Silmarillion. In the Silmarillion, you do see that pattern. Those who are really great, those who are really mighty, do have a really strong temptation to fall and do sometimes go bad. And so then when you come to The Lord of the Rings and you see, you hear Elrond, for instance, saying, "It seems like this job is meant to be done by the small instead of the great." You can really sort of see this is like Iluvatar's answer, basically, to, you know, the mighty who are falling, to say, no, look, the way that I want things, the way things are supposed to go is like this. The humble are elevated, and it's through the small that these great things are done. And it's just that all really fits together really well.
Are you familiar with David Brin?
No, I don't know David Brin.
David Brin is a science fiction author, again.
Okay.
He's been fairly critical of the adulation that the masses are giving to Tolkien, because to him, Tolkien represents a sort of political regression. You know, people are clamoring for a king. You know, we want our Caesar, and the Tea Party folks may well, you know, find their Caesar and thrust him up and expect him to act like a Caesar is supposed to, you know, and crush the opposition and dictate. And I was reading just last night in the Silmarillion, and I don't remember the characters' names, but the king who is married to one of the Valar.
Yes.
One of the Noldor.
Fingol is his name.
Fingol.
Yeah.
One of the Noldor, who had to walk up through, you know, the icy north to get around, shows up, and Fingol has just learned of the kinslaying and the burning of the ships, and he's mad.
Yes.
And he's mad at who's the visitor?
Well, it's the sons of Finarfin who are there, who are... Finarfin is a close kin of Thingol. Yeah, well, we don't have to go through the whole genealogy. See, I say to resist the genealogies. Anyway, they're kinsmen of his.
Yes. The Noldor, who are this group of elves who decided to leave Valar, which is the Undying Lands, came back to Middle-earth, and they came in two groups. One, led by Feanor, who is totally gone bad, goes and kills some other elves, takes their fine ships, sails across to Middle-earth, and then burns the ships.
Abandoning his kinsmen on the other side,
Who then take this really awful, perilous, treacherous course up north and around. And when Thingol finds out about that, he's so mad, he says, "The language of the elves who went to Valinor will not be spoken here, period."
That's right.
Which is classical political repression of a minority group, which is just evil in my book. And he's not a bad character, but he's done something that bad kings and bad governments do throughout history and continue to do today, like in Turkey.
Although, one major difference there is that the group whose language is being suppressed, they're numerically a minority, but they're the most powerful people on the whole continent. So, I mean, they are the people who are come over and have become essentially overlords everywhere except in Doriath, where Thingol is ruling, and a couple cities down by the coast. So they're basically running the place. So it is an act more of defiance. I mean, it would be... I'm hesitant to draw a modern political parallel. Sort of thinking of the Cold War, but of course it's just not quite right. But anyway, though the parallel is deeply awkward, I'll still do it. It's more like, you know, if Reagan had responded to Khrushchev by saying, and, you know, the Russian language shall never more be spoken again in my ears, and anyone who speaks the Russian language shall be held a traitor. That is an act of aggression, sort of, horizontally rather than vertically down, because he's definitely not oppressing the Noldor, because the Noldor are in charge, and they're in charge everywhere, and they are far more numerous and more powerful than he in his own kingdom. But it is a, and the Noldor do it. I mean, for the sake of keeping peace, they only speak their own language among themselves. And, you know, from that day on, Sindarin is the language that's spoken in Beleriand, because, you know, he Thingol says, yeah, anyone who speaks the language Quenya, the language of Valinor, will be held to be slayers of kin unrepentant. You know, you're basically owning the kin slaying if you speak this language. And that's that I don't think is an evil act itself necessarily. Again, it's a defiant act on Thingol's part, and it's part of the kind of complicated political struggle between him and complicated political relationship between him and the Noldor in Beleriand, because he's the only real king when they get back. He is the primary power. But of course, when they return, they find him awkwardly besieged by the orcs who have overrun the whole rest of the country, which is what some of the Noldor say in response when they hear about his decree. You know, they say, look, he should be grateful that he has the Noldor for his neighbors and not the orcs that we found here. Right. So he can shut up. But they actually do, you know, stop speaking Quenya in public because they don't want to cause trouble. And also because they know that they're guilty. Like the kinslaying weighs on them. I mean, they don't like to think about the kinslaying because but most of the rest of them that have come over are not really, some of Fëanor's sons are also crazy, but not all of them, and many of them are deeply repentant of the kinslaying and yet are still burdened by it. So that's sort of another reason why they would go along with it. But yeah, the questions of power, political power, as it's depicted in Tolkien, is something which is hard for a lot of modern readers.
You'd think the elves would be elevated. So, you know, perhaps they would be democratic or perhaps anarcho-syndicalists or something. But no, they're kings. They rule in succession. Although it's weird to have, rule by lineal descent with immortal beings. The only way the king's ever going to check out is in battle, pretty much, or by betrayal.
Right. Which doesn't happen that often. I mean, in the whole First Age, which lasts thousands of years, there are four kings.
If you're first in line to the throne, find a hobby.
Well, yeah. Well, and that's, of course, the point, is that it's not in any way... Their society isn't run by succession. I mean, there's no anxiety of succession among the elves as there is among humans, because, you know, whenever there's a mortal king, like, time is ticking and we've got to make sure we have a plan for what's going to happen when he dies. And, of course, the elves, that's a little less pressing for them. But, yeah, I mean, one thing that is pretty clear is that in Tolkien's mind, democracy is not necessarily enlightened. And, you know, again, Plato didn't think so either.
Oh, well, Plato's a fascist. Yeah. But, you know, I think it was William Churchill who said that, yes, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others that have been tried.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's one of the things that he is really envisioning is not just, if you think about the political structures, especially the monarchies in Tolkien, just as what a modern monarchy is or would be. I mean, as you said, if we, you know, if a faction of Americans rose up and crowned a king of America, what that would look like. That's not at all what Tolkien is envisioning in any way. And you have to go back to, you have to see the whole picture of not only who the king is and what the king does, but how the people respond and how they live and what they and what their own attitude is towards it. I mean, it's clear that he is envisioning a completely different society ground up from ours, and not just trying to impose that political system upon our world. You do get, you know, I think in some ways, Tolkien's ideal of government, his one of his main convictions about government was he was very anti-big government. He was anti-medium-sized government. the Shire is a pretty good indication. It's, you know, it is not monarchical. There is a Thane of the Shire, but it's a title that they barely even talk about anymore, and he doesn't
There's
wield
no
any power.
Standing army of hobbits. There's no National Guard that the Thane can direct here and
right.
there. And yeah.
Absolutely not. There's no military. There's not even any police except, you know, the bounders, you know, people who like try to keep, you know, wild animals from coming through, or also, as he says, help to capture, you know, like to, he implies that, you know, one of their jobs is helping to recapture livestock that has strayed and stuff. I mean, you know, they don't, there's not a lot of law enforcement that happens in the Shire that's needed in the Shire. There's a mayor, you know, who is technically the sort of ruler governor of the Shire, but all he does is preside at parties. I mean, he doesn't really do very much. In a lot of ways, Tolkien's ideal government is people minding their own homesteads and government not interfering. But then you have kings. Yeah, and you have the relationship between the people and the kings. And here, this is part of the epic tradition. You know, and there is an idea behind this which has nothing to do with practical modern politics. You know, there is an idea, the idea of the return of the king and the relation, the what we can see that it means to the people of Gondor to have the king restored to the throne, what we can see that it means to the people of Rohan to have the king riding forth to battle instead of sitting back in his throne room decrepitly. That is a bigger epic idea, which again, it doesn't have anything to do with modern politics, I think, in Tolkien's mind. I mean, that doesn't amount to, like, kings are awesome and, like, all governments should be monarchies. Rather, what he's doing is he is exploring this ancient and really, it's a very Anglo-Saxon idea of the loving and really intimate and in a deep way, symbiotic relationship between the king and the people and the king and the land. And that's when a land is whole, a land is healthy, when it has a king like that, who has to be a good king too. I mean, a bad king poisons the country. And as we see, you know, bad kings leading nations in bad. I mean, look at Numenor, what happens in Numenor. You know, their kings go bad and the whole place goes.
Or with Theoden, as the king is decrepit, so is the
land.
Yeah,
exactly,
country.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, that's it's symbiotic and sort of, yeah, literally symbiotic. It goes both ways, but yeah, I to just take from that. I mean, when you read his letters, when he's actually talking about his own political views, he sounds increasingly like an anarchist as time goes on by the end of his life. He is very resistant to governments and to bureaucracy and to war. And he has a deep distrust for political leaders and thinks that they should just like stop minding people's business for them. And, you know, so I mean, he comes close to anarchism by the end of his life in his private views, in his private expressions. But in his books, he's not going to say that anarchism is the ideal, because it's not. And it's not part of that legend that he's telling anyway. I mean, again, the closest that you get to, like, the anarchist ideal is the Shire. But, of course, that's premised upon a place where the people are all really good. I mean, people don't commit crimes, generally, in the Shire. Yeah. I mean, you know, Frodo makes that outrageous claim that there's never been a deliberate murder ever in the history of the Shire, in the recorded history of the Shire, which is a doubtful claim. Tolkien told a story at one point about there was, anyway, death under mysterious circumstances. But anyway, I mean, still...
Well, Smeagol seems like a variety of hobbit, and he obviously committed murder.
But it was a huge deal.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the thing. Like, you can tell, like, what a big deal the ring was, because he murdered, you know, Daigle. So, I mean, that was really bad. that was a very big deal. But yeah, so, I mean, so even that, you can't even say, oh, he really would like everything to be like the Shire. Well, maybe he would like things to be like the Shire. But he knew full well that if you were to institute the Shire governments in England, it wouldn't look like the Shire. You know, so again, I don't think that, I think it's dangerous to be looking at the political systems that he describes in his books and really be kind of just projecting them onto contemporary situations. As he wouldn't have done that in any kind of a direct way.
That's all for the first session. Check out the Sea Realm podcast to hear the second half of our conversation, in which we discuss the dangers of technological advance in the modern age. As always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.